Happy Fascism Friday, everyone.
Good morning.
This is January 15th, 2021, and this is episode 156 of Transmission. And it's going to be a good one because Dan and I were already getting worked up before.
Yeah.
We kind of talk beforehand each time, but this one I'm having to hold back. So we have all kinds of thoughts. We hope you have all kinds of thoughts about this. There's lots of little moving parts. In some ways, this is stuff we've been talking about the whole time, but we want to advance the conversation. But first, we should introduce
first.
There's Bubo. For those who are listening and not watching, we have a knit robotic owl that is the mascot created by Catherine and Adam, who listen and are
who is actually the leader of Antifa.
Bubo, the robot owl.
Yes.
What about Jason? Jason, the goose from that was seen at Antifa.
All right, Jason.
So
Bubo is the true leader of Antifa.
Jason is just the subcomandante of Antifa West.
Yes.
So, I'm Mark Van Stewick. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing, and good morning to those of you in America, and good evening to those of you in Eastern Europe or other parts of the world. We had Myanmar yesterday. That was awesome. And we've had folks in the Philippines watch. And
internationally acclaimed.
That's really fun.
Video transmission. Today we're talking, we're covering a few interrelated things today. We're already starting to... When you start talking about fascism in America right now, there's this tendency to look at this as an anomaly, that this is a new thing. We've talked about that. It's not new. This has been a culmination. And we also tend to talk about it as though, those stupid, these charismatic prophets are fighting amongst themselves. Some of the prominent ones who will have the integrity to say, you know what, I was wrong, have been getting death threats. Other prophets are saying,
And not only that, but actually the funniest thing to me about all of that is how they're suddenly saying oh my gosh, these Trumpers are crazy. I had no idea, which just goes to show, how the human mind is really adept at ignoring reality.
And people live in their bubbles. They use this is the thing. Christian ministers, particularly amongst evangelicals and charismatics, are so used to overstating things. I'm on fire for Jesus. I have a radical faith in our Lord Jesus Christ. We need to go to the streets and proclaim his love. But they don't do it. It's this over the top way of speaking. And so then all of a sudden when people take it seriously, they're like, oh wow, I didn't know.
Oops.
And so we point to evangelicals and charismatics, and then a lot of people who are progressive mainliners or Catholics are like, you know what, those evangelicals are crazy. But just to kind of frame this, maybe I'll post this right now. Look, you can see, for those who can't read along, this is recent this is polling data basically for the election. And most pollsters think that Trump performs better than is actually polled. Because people don't like to self-report that they like Trump. All U.S. registered voters, 42% were polling for Trump, 52% for Biden. But if you look just at white people, white evangelical Protestants, 78% for Trump. But then if you cut that out and go right to what we think of as the progressive mainline, it's still 53% for Trump. White Catholics, right. 52% for Trump. So a majority of white Christians, generally across the board, and there might be some outliers like among Quakers and stuff. But generally speaking, it's not like there's no room for white superiority over other white superiority. It's just this weird kind of recognition that this is about whiteness more than it is about evangelicalism in particular. Yeah. And we have to ask, why are the evangelicals getting riled up? And we have some things to say about how I think inevitably every white denomination will support authoritarianism if it means their survival is at stake.
Right. Yeah, and so, you know, particularly, and I was just listening to this conversation that a couple of the head Presbyterian staff folks, the Washington office and the stated clerk were having yesterday. And, you know, they were talking about how, you know, Christianity needs to be anti-white supremacist and support justice and, you know, saying all this great stuff. Mm-hmm. But then there's always this really weird hinge point that these conversations get to. And, you know, I've been listening to this for decades. I mean, at first it was, you know, with whether or not it was okay to marry gay people and have gay pastors, you know, now it's around, you know, whiteness and all these different things. And the weird hinge point is this, you know, so the guy says, we need to remember, we're not white, and we're not red churches or blue churches, we're Christian churches. And we need to remember that Christianity is about this guy, Jesus, who is on the margins. And of course, politics is connected to everything. So it's okay to talk about politics. And we just need to realize that everybody's Christian and needs to support these justice-oriented things. And it ignores the fact that all those red Christians, right, the majority who voted for Trump, are not going to suddenly change their mind about what you think Christianity is about just because you've told them that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they say, well, you know, pastors don't preach these things. It's like, well, pastors don't preach these things because they're going to get fired or because their biggest donors are going to leave the church. And so, this idea that suddenly we can kind of convince all these folks who basically have bought into a Christianity that is absolutely allied with whiteness and with capitalism. And by the way, the real problem with these situations is that those red folks are all the richest folks because they're the ones most committed to capitalism. They are the biggest donors in these churches.
Yep.
And so the real elephant in the room that we don't talk about, along with politics, is then money.
It's economics.
It's economics. And that that the only way a church after fascism becomes non-fascist is if it's also willing to let go of not just its allegiance politically with some of these movements, but also economically. And that's what really scares the crap out of people, because, of course, the higher up in hierarchies you go in the church, just like in corporations, you make more money, right? Like I think the salary should be inverted. Like, bishops should make less than everybody else, not more, right? The bigger congregation you pastor, you should make less than the person that pastors the 15-member congregation. Right,
you're stepping on toes, Dan. This idea, like, okay, I know, like, you pissed someone off this week about this, talking about this on Facebook, and I've been bringing it up because it's so an amazing snapshot.
Yeah, but
generally speaking, the people who rise in the ranks, this isn't always true, this is a generalization, it's never not always true, tend to be the most adept at beating mediocre, moderate technocrats. Who are able to balance the, like, maintain the status quo and please as many parties as possible. This is why people tend to raise through the ranks. I've seen this in my the Mennonite church.
I mean, it happens all the time.
Well, we have this professionalized clergy. You have to pay for pensions. Like, there's so much that makes sense. Like, you want workers to get paid, but at the end of the day, people want to maintain institutions. Like, so, if, you know, William Stringfellow is a thinker that I'm influenced by. A lot of people don't know who he was. He was a gay Episcopal man who was tied in with the Catholic worker movement. Wrote a book called Ethics for Christians and Other Strangers in Land. I can't remember the title, but he talks about, look up William Stringfellow. He talks about how churches and every institution is a principality and a power. because by definition, institutions tend to need to continue themselves. And most institutions become vampiric, willing to sacrifice people for the integrity of the institution. Now, white institutions, by definition, will maintain whiteness because white systems of power are what keep them in place. And this is, by the way, I can't speak for people of color, but I've heard enough of this to know it's generally true. And it's something we have to think about. The reason why white people, even progressive white people, are suspect is because we act as though being progressive or radical is a luxury. When our institutions are thriving enough to not have to be conservative in order to maintain themselves, we can spend some of our progressive points on these causes. But as the moment these causes challenge the integrity of the institution, we slap back and become like Luther Seminary in town or any seminary almost everywhere, which plays the middle of the road to not offend people. This is how you get churches, you get like evangelicals trying to maintain power by throwing their weight behind fascism, and you have the mainline denominations complicit in fascism by not speaking out loudly enough or at all. Mm-hmm. And this, so we're inevitably going to come back and back to this point because our institutions matter more to our Christianity than the people and sermon. We got to own that. We got to be willing to let our institutions die, white institutions die, or we'll keep coming back to this point.
Yep. So we got some comments, a lot of hellos, which is great.
Wiley writes, reminds me of a Chappelle Show skit about Mr. Ed the Racist Horse. I vaguely remember that. I'm going to go look that up after this is done. CK reminds us that Jason the Goose is an unofficial representative. Thank you for that clarification. Gus also talking about Jason. Are Jason and Bubo now Lenin and Trotsky of Antofagasta? Will one get an ice pick to place further down the road? Oh, wow. That's some deep inside leftist talk.
Deep.
he had to clarify Antifa, not Antofagasta. How did you autocorrect come up with Antofagasta?
Antofagasta. You know, that sounds like an pasta dish.
With antipasto in it. So it's a bad Italian accent. It's very sensitive. CKS talking about the charismatic ministers. Do they have integrity or are they saving their own ass? I think it's a mix. But a lot of these prophets, by fessing up, actually knew they were hurting themselves. So I do think even in that shit show, there are people with integrity within their own framework. Their framework is crap, but they still have some integrity within it. But like, I'm not going to push that part to point too far. I don't want to be an apologist for them. CK writes, the chickens are coming home to roost. There's a lot of bird analogies in the show, and I'm okay with that. Mark writes, in the data you presented, I think we need to acknowledge the power of party affiliation and loyalty. I feel many who voted for Trump did so because of the party he represents. At least that is what the optimist in me wants to believe. Mm-hmm. I think there's truth to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but definitely.
It's not the whole truth, but there's truth to that.
No, I mean, there are a lot of people that just, you know, they vote Republican, they vote Democrat. That's what they've done all their lives. That's what their parents did. Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
But then, we also have to look back at primaries. Trump rose to the top of the primaries for a reason, not just because of people's party affiliation. So there's definitely a strong faction that isn't just going along with things, but wants a Trump direction, you know. Susan writes, just the white Christianity that does not live and preach the value of Jesus. That is not even Christianity. I understand. There's a lot in that statement that I can kind of go along with, but you know, I tend to go shy away from this idea of saying, oh, that's not true Christianity, because like at a certain point, the dominant expression of Christianity for 2000 years gets to be the textbook definition rather than the Platonic ideal of Christianity that we strive for, that we have never really fully lived up to in any large scale. And so if what you mean by that is like, that's not faithful to Jesus, so anything that's not faithful to Jesus, we should throw out. But the problem is every denomination leadership thinks that they're generally more faithful than not, but the sum totality of their actions kind of supports the weight of American imperialism.
Yeah, and you know, and I've actually gotten in arguments and discussions with folks about this sort of statement. You know, how do you define Christianity? And you know, and I'm sort of all over the place on this. I mean, I can see all sorts of different approaches. On the one hand, I can understand the desire to put forward this, as you say, Mark, this sort of Platonic ideal of Christianity or certain manifestations and saying, well, these are closer than others. Mm-hmm. But I also understand the people that just say, hey, look, if somebody says they're a Christian, then that's Christianity, whether you like it or not. And so everything that manifests as Christianity is Christianity. It's a challenging conversation.
To me, the heart of the question is how it functions. So, like, if if we take your statement, those aren't real Christians at full value, how does that inform my actions? This tends to be how I like to approach things. And often, I'm not saying you're saying this, but a lot of people, when they say that, it's a way of washing their hands of any sort of complicity and any responsibility to remedy that. Now, one of the things Dan and I were talking about beforehand is, if let's take that in the most positive way we can, saying that's not real Christianity. If people say that enough, then what I would like to see is denominations split along these sorts of lines about justice. Like, part of this, one of the idols we have is this faux unity idea that we have to somehow hold hands with people, no matter whether they're racist or not, whether or not they're warmongers or not, because Christianity is so important. Well, Christian unity, in my mind, starts with the oppressed. And if a denomination, if people in a denomination recognize, like, look, we got to be about this Jesus stuff, they need to be willing to break and do their own thing, even if it hurts their bottom line, so they can have integrity and solidarity. So if we're going to start saying that is an aberration to what I believe the gospel to be, then we need to follow through with it and not blame these other people saying, yeah, they don't like gay people, so I guess my church can't be really open and affirming, and I'll have to wait another couple of decades before we can actually like fully recognize the full humanity of my trans brothers, sisters, and kin.
And historically, when you look at groups and people and communities that have done that, what you see absolutely consistently is that they remain small without political and worldly power, right? Which, you know, is what Jesus was and who Jesus was. And, you know, the hard part is, right? The hard part is that people want all that stuff, right? People want all that stuff. Mark and I, for who we are and our level of intelligence and our level of education, I mean, we are worldly failures. You know, we are not, you know, we are not bishops. We are not vice presidents of corporations. We are not, and it's not because we're not capable of any of those things. It's because our anti-institutional stances for a lot of things, you know, you get blowback for that. You get smacked down for that. And so, you know, I think that, and if you look, you know, I'm thinking about movements like the Beguine movement. I'm looking at movements like the Catholic worker movements. I'm looking at movements like a lot of the monastic communities that are committed to living in poverty. You know, they don't get invited to the White House. In fact, they may get burned at the stake. you know, and this again, I mean, this is the very difficult paradox, right? And so if you've risen to a high level and you're sitting there and some, you know, I mean, I remember when the Presbyterian Church a while back was having this debate about the pension and healthcare plan, right? And the Presbyterian Board of Pensions is one of the richest organizations in America. They have billions of dollars in the bank. And for the number of people that they're serving, you know, the earth could blow up. And I joke that the Board of Pensions would sort of maintain itself as this little planet orbiting the sun, you know, self-sufficient for eternity with all the money they have. And they were looking at, you know, cutting pension benefits. And one of the guys on the board gets up at the beginning of this debate and starts talking about, you know, the challenges of living, of having your own yacht, and launches into this analogy about, you know, having a yacht. And, you know, it's really hard when you have a yacht and you have to maintain a yacht. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I need some fucking investment banker or something that's on this board. I'm thinking to myself, do you know how many pastors have a fucking yacht? Like, not too many. And yet, you know, that was the reality that he lived in and wanted to live in. And so then he has risen to a point where he has control over whether or not, you know, pastors making 30 grand in the middle of nowhere, you know, get health care. So this is the real challenge, you know, the paradox of faith and politics and money that we're always up against.
Yep. I could say a lot more about that. But yeah,
so we've got a lot of
comments. Susan writes, institutional corruption of politics went through the churches to the core. Exactly. Follow the money. And, you know, that's entirely true. And it's also entirely true that a denomination doesn't even have to be corrupt to be complicit, depending on how you use the word corrupt. I think it's the normal baked-in operating system, you know, and we have to challenge it, you know. I mean, this is the whole thing about Jesus pointing to the cross as an ethical framework, which is all kinds of complexities with that. But at the very least, we have to be willing to lay down sustainability in this cause of justice, in proportion to the amount of power, influence, and prestige we have in a society, which is why the white church in America is such a failure at Christianity, even though it's a success when it comes to religion. Even though when it's in decline, like Dan is saying, there's still billions of dollars wrapped up in this white Christianity thing. There isn't, Medina says that living inverted, Dan. Did you say living inverted as a comment somewhere back, Dan? Thank
you. Yeah, we're talking about, you know, bishops making the least amount.
Oh, yeah. Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I'm with that. Totally. Yeah. Stefan writes, servant leadership, the community should decide the pay of its leaders.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with that, right, is that if you have this framework, though, where the community, you know, so in most white churches in America, the pastor is the one person who is supposed to practice Christianity, and everybody else is, they're just kidding, right? And so everybody knows what the pastor makes, and, you know, you get publicly beat on for making too much, and, you know, jokes told about you. You just work 1 hour a week, and wow, you make all this money. You know,
I'd love to get money to have in coffee.
You make a whole $30,000 a year. And of course, everybody else, they make however much money they want. They do whatever they want with their money. One stewardship season, I said, well, look, you all know how much I make. So what I think we're going to do is we're going to post around the church the salary of every member of the church. And then we can all talk about how much we're all making. Oh, my God.
That didn't go well.
You should see the looks on people's faces. I thought I was going to have to break out the serious psychoactive medication.
Yeah.
But that's what we need to do. And see, if we did that, if we were all practicing Christians, and we were all deciding how much all of us made, right? And this is why, you know, the monastic rules are very intentional about addressing economics. Then I would be fine with the community deciding the pay of its leaders. But the way that it works now, it doesn't go well. for those leaders at all.
Elias writes, how do we turn that hierarchy upside down? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a good question, like, because part of it is we're so good at being sneaky. There are denominations that, like, the term servant leadership Stefan brought up, like, which I totally agree with that concept. Mm-hmm. Everybody uses that concept to just, like, and they, without irony, as they, like, as their bishops are making $200,000 a year, or, you know, I'm pretty sure Joel Osteen thinks of himself as a servant leader. we always, in like within the Mennonite church, we talk about the upside down kingdom. But then if you look at the Mennonite system, it looks fundamentally not that distinguishable from other systems. So it's a real challenge. And part of it is like we have to get to the point of honesty. Like this is why I like what Dan said about, I'm sure some of you clenched your pot talks when you started hearing about sharing your how much money you make with your whole church. That's a very scary idea. But unless we can get to that level of honesty about things, and start dealing in reality and talking about terms in a true way, we're just going to start deceiving ourselves, just like those super progressive churches that will only say things that are only barely challenging. Like, well, what does progressive mean to you then?
No.
CK writes, capital Christo-fascism.
Yep.
It's an unwieldy term, but apt. David writes, reminds me of when my own denomination started highlighting the need to dismantle white supremacy, and white critics responded by saying, but this will tear the church apart, which begs the question, is whiteness all that is holding some of us together?
Yes. Yes.
given that, like, if you start trying to define, even using the term whiteness bothers the hell out of people. But once you can get them on board to saying, well, this whiteness thing is a problem, getting people to be able to share an understanding of what it even means is hard. It really is the water that white people swim in. We can't. The analogy of fish don't know what water is. That's kind of what we think about with whiteness. When people of color try to tell us what whiteness is, we just, the easy thing that white people do is saying, well, I agree with some of that, but gee, you seem angry, or that's just a little harsh. Maybe you're the racist. We go into that because we can't really even begin to even imagine what not whiteness looks like for ourselves.
Yep.
Ceres writes, personally, all imperial whiteness needs to die. Amen. Even American liberalism and leftism is tainted with whiteness, and that both either drift to authoritarianism or libertarianism. I keep hearing how some white left anarchists thought they could work with the FBI to stop the far right. That is the same group that often are the first to enable accountability abuse and firing squad, while abusers just slip right into movement spaces.
Yeah, I remember a little while ago at some point in the Trump presidency when suddenly everybody on the left thought that, you know, the head of the CIA was like some sort of, you know, great political savior because they made some nice comment that was anti-Trump. And I was just flabbergasted. I mean, I was seeing this all over. All these liberal people were like, yay, the head of the CIA. And I'm like, the CIA is suddenly the good guys? Like, what happened?
I mean,
was so weird.
In Dan's lifetime, for sure, and probably mine, these agencies murdered black leaders. Like, come on, man.
Many.
An entire generation of prominent black leadership was annihilated, like, a generation ago.
Well, and not to mention people of color leaders all over the planet.
Oh, for sure. And let's not act as though somehow they're all buddy-buddy with Black Lives Matter. Even if there are some high-ranking black folks in the CIA and FBI, white supremacist organizations don't change just because you put some not white people in there. Like, it's structural.
The Attorney General of Kentucky is black. Mm-hmm. How did that go for Breonna Taylor's family?
So white supremacy is not just the sum totality of individual white racist thoughts projected outward. It's baked in. And I say this all the time because I think it's important. is that if I were a wizard and it could eradicate racism from every human heart today, we'd still have white supremacy tomorrow. Okay, we need to understand that.
So, Mark, we're doomed. It's half an hour. We've got
we care all about these stuff. Comments.
So we care about. Through.
We lose control.
We love your comments.
Tassi writes, the church and deaf is deaf on keeping POC and other people safe next week.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Like I don't want to be too. Yeah. Okay.
Keep going, Mark.
This is hard for me to focus. Okay. Vershal writes, to the point about leadership, I once heard someone sum up the episcopacy by saying someone is either a good pastor or a good administrator, but the people who rise to the top are rarely both. You know, that's, I'm just going to let that statement stand on its own. Amen. Julia writes, a slaveholder religion has had a long life. It's true. William writes, have you looked at Underground Seminary as an alternative to United or Luther locally? Yeah, Underground Seminary is connected with Church of All Nations. It's, you know, I could say a lot. I think United's good. I think Luther's has its qualities. Underground Seminary is great for what they're trying to do. These systems are bigger than just like opting into a better, slightly better system. And, you know, part of it is not even just tied up in Luther as having a problem. Like they're tied into a larger ELCA problem, which is tied into a whole capitalist problem. So it's elephants all the way down. And it, you can't just focus on one little institution and think that, well, we can have integrity and be detached from the rest of this toxic system. This has to be a collective project across institutions and systems. And it has to start with honesty, not just like the vague honesty of like white supremacy is a problem, but really being honest about our complicity in it and doing like Dan said, start showing our checkbooks and
how we've been into the details. Yep.
Yep. Kathleen writes, in the 1980s, I was a lay member of a Missouri UMC church. We received a survey question from the conference asking if we would accept a black pastor. Oh my gosh. The council said no. It is only recently that I've realized how incredibly racist it was that we were even asked that question.
No.
Tassi writes, the Anglicans in Canada did this and the Indigenous Church gained their own sovereignty last year.
No. Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting work going on up in Canada around these things. I'd encourage people to check that out. In many ways, they're sort of way ahead of where we're at down here and, you know, for a lot of different reasons, but yeah, it's there's some very interesting things happening.
David writes, thank you for naming Faux Unity. I'm not Methodist, but as a queer person, I've been so moved by the Methodist wanting to break off and form queer-affirming churches, knowing how they are willing to go, how far they're willing to go to say people like me matter. That feels like Jesus. Mm-hmm. Thanks for saying that.
Right. I mean, the Methodist Church is going through this right now, and they're having this major meltdown, and they're probably going to split in a bunch of different parts. And, you know, that's what needs to happen, because, yeah, trotting out the same old arguments about, you know, here are my favorite Bible quotes, here are my favorite Bible quotes, you know, that support my relative positions, it just doesn't go anywhere.
And just to underscore, I don't want to pick fights just on the Luther and charismatics and evangelicals, just to add in the Methodists. It's kind of a lie if you're an individual Methodist congregation to say you're open and affirming if your denomination isn't. Like, how is it? Right. It's shitty to go to a church thinking, oh, they really affirm me. And then you're like, well, we do, but we're part of this institution that doesn't. So you can't go as far beyond these walls and find acceptance. And we wish we could do something about it, but our hands are tied. Like, that's not open and affirming. That's on the way to being open and affirming. And so that these churches are willing to break, like, again, this idol of unity needs to really be questioned. Medina says, yay to worldly failures. You're doing it right.
Thank you.
It often doesn't feel very right. It's very hard. Khan writes, then should we protest government with any hope of change if we are to remain small?
Yes, absolutely. Because again, a lot of small cells can end up having a lot of power, right? So, and this gets to the imagination piece. You know, we have to be able to imagine that humanity can be different. I mean, we've talked some about hope and what that really means, and false hope and helpful. You know, my hope, I mean, what keeps me going is a sense that we can be different, that we as a species can be different. Now, what's that going to look like? How are we going to get there? I have no idea. Am I ever going to see that? Is it going to be, you know, when we're all on planet Zork together in some different form? I don't know. But yeah, we have to keep feeling that there can be something different, because, you know, there's just too much suffering. And so, yes, we have to keep protesting and organizing and working and communicating and doing our own thing and in our own place. Absolutely. I don't know any other way to live.
You know, and it's, we could have a whole conversation or multiple conversations about this, but I think there's a kind of a trap in this idea that you can rise to the ranks of power within our system, and that's more effective at bringing change. Now, I'm an anarchist, so I obviously have biases when it comes to this, but I really don't think that's usually how change really works. Like, even like some of the most successful revolutionary type movements, like the Zapatistas, it's not like that small group of people in the Chiapas had a lot of power within Mexico. That's not how they got about it. They just said, we're just going to like leverage what we have and do our own thing here in the Chiapas. Lots of groups start small. Lots of things change happen small and through agitation. So, but if we have people that are willing to work within the system and they actually have integrity, great. But I don't think we should use that as our primary strategy of like, well, I guess we have to stay like a big denomination, be beholden to donors, and play it down the middle in order to gain influence so that maybe someday someone can rise to the ranks who has integrity to do an Oscar Romero. Like, I think the Oscar Romero plan is not something we can kind of keep applying. CK writes, I think that a lot of this can be explained by the fact that as humans, our brains are on autopilot. We don't engage our conscious mind as often as we think we do.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Don writes, how many pastors have a yacht? I laughed out loud.
I mean, yeah.
I don't, and yeah. Does a pontoon count as a yacht, Dan?
I don't think in that guy's mind.
Because you can totally put like a canopy over it, put a bed in there. So that's a yacht. Lance writes, when we talk who and what churches we call Christian, I think about Jesus's teaching. You build monuments to the prophets and say had we lived then, we would not have taken part in spilling their blood, therefore testifying that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets. I think we contemporary Christians renounce the oppression or sightsightedness of the previous generations, but fail to recognize our participation in the current system. Amen, Lance. Yeah. I think that's
totally, you know, true. So Mark, I think we're going to have to call this.
Oh man, so many comments.
I know.
Let's do a couple more, and then we'll
okay.
Just
we love all your comments so much.
Yeah, Siri's just going to, you know, decentralization sadly doesn't guarantee that imperial whiteness stops being powerful. QAnon is an example of decentralized imperial white supremacy getting steam. Right. Evangelicals and charismatics are decentralized. I think decentralization has a great like organizational tactic baked into it, but it doesn't, it's not.
Doesn't guarantee anything.
It doesn't guarantee anything. It's just a tactical way of delivering information and organizing people. Jumping down, see if there's any comments from people. Let's get to Julia here. In the mid-80s, my home was robbed. Only thing taken was every piece of paper in the house, including photos, letters, date books, address books, and everything in filing cabinets. Community members then informed me what COINTELPRO was. Mm. Yeah, so that's it. Like, you know, they go after information, they try to gather data, and they take down leaders. Catherine writes, reminds me of a line of this poem, how to explain white supremacy to a white supremacist, by local artist Guante. White supremacy is not the shark, it's the water. Amen. And last word from Tyler, who hasn't commented in this episode yet. Since it's Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday today, quote, "First, I must confess that over the last few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride towards freedom is not the White Citizens Council or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace." And then the comment cuts off there. That's a good place to end because MLK Day is Monday. We're not going to be on for much of next week because I'm going to be away in a remote cabin. Yeah. Right. So I don't think
we'll be back. So we're not on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday?
And Thursday.
Oh my gosh.
It will be all right. Fascism Friday next week.
From one Fascism Friday to another.
Sorry everybody.
All right. Well, we love you guys. Thanks so much for all the great comments and participation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I hope everyone has a better weekend than they had last weekend. That's as much optimism as I can muster. See ya. Thank you.